Thank you. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, a false flag terror attack is when the group, country or political faction blamed for a bomb or other outrage are actually the enemy of the people who actually carried it out. It's rather like the grisly phenomenon of self-harming. The aim is simple: to make an aggressor look like a victim and the victim look like the aggressor. One telltale sign of this is when there's a very quick revelation as to who's behind an attack, like on 9/11 and 7/7, when Bush and Blair respectively announced on the day of the attacks that Islamic factions were likely to be behind it all. But NATO has a disturbing track record of this kind of cowardly attack. It's called Operation Gladio, and it was supposed to be the most secret operation NATO ever carried out. But some of those tasked to carry out these attacks were so disgusted with what they'd been ordered to do that they blew the whistle. Swiss historian Daniel Ganser and I spoke to him recently about the topic of his book, because he's done thorough research on the subject, starting in London. His book is called NATO's Secret Armies.
Historian researching international politics and economic affairs of the last 60 years. I teach at Basel University in Switzerland, and my book NATO's Secret Armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe deals with secret warfare in Western Europe during the Cold War. In Italy, the secret army was named Gladio. So many people know of the whole story with that keyword Gladio, because if you type in Gladio on the internet, that's really the keyword that brings you to these secret armies. And it was the name of the stay behind army of NATO in Italy, and it was discovered in 1990, so that's already 20 years ago. A stay behind army is a secret network of soldiers who waits until an invasion has actually happened and until a country is occupied. So it stays behind enemy lines and has arms caches across the country and then fights the occupying powers. So it's sort of special forces who operate behind enemy lines. The important thing to understand is that the secret armies had two purposes. First, they were to be ready in case of a Soviet invasion. I mean, if you think back the Cold War, we always had this fear in Western Europe that the Soviet Union would invade and occupy Western Europe. So British and American soldiers and generals planned for that event and therefore set up secret armies. But they were not only fearing a Soviet invasion, they were also fearing communist parties who were active in democracies of Western Europe quite in peacetime, you know. And so some of the terrorist attacks that were carried out in Italy seemed to be linked to right-wing terrorists who carried out these attacks with support of the secret armies and then blamed them on the Italian communists and the socialists just to discredit the left. I mean, that is called false flag terrorism, and it works.
Why should you really fear a communist party if that communist party, as in Italy, for example, is democratically elected and that's what the people want?
Because the communist party in Italy, you know, they were very strong in parliament. They had some 30% of the vote. At some point, you know, if you're strong in the legislative branch, you want to have minister positions. So you want maybe to have the interior minister or you want to have the defense minister. An Italian defense minister from a communist party would have been a total nightmare for NATO, because within NATO they were circulating all NATO secrets, and they thought that the Italian communists would hand over these NATO secrets directly to Moscow. So this idea that the Italian population votes for somebody whom NATO doesn't want was really the problem during the Cold War. We didn't have full sovereignty. We had democracies, but democracy was limited. You see that in the case of Aldo Moro, who was assassinated when he wanted to bring the Italian communists into the government. I mean, he was a high-ranking politician, but he was assassinated.
There were terrorist attacks in the 1980s, particularly in Italy. Can you give us an example of a couple of those which initially people thought were sponsored by the Soviet Union but actually turned out to be run by NATO?
The most famous attack is the one of 1972, which was carried out in Peteano. It was just a small attack with like two or five people who were lured to a car, and the car then exploded. There was a few policemen who were lured to the place by an anonymous phone call. And this attack was first blamed on the Red Brigade. So there was an anonymous phone call and who said this attack has been carried out by the Red Brigade. And then everybody thought, okay, it was the left. And then 10 years later, an Italian judge, Felice Casson, investigated the attack again and found out that it had been a right-wing terrorist, Vincenzo Vinciguerra. So there we have the exact names. And the man, Vinciguerra, then confessed that he carried out the attack. And he said, yeah, but we were protected by NATO. They had a secret network. And everybody was saying, yeah, the man is just lying. You know, he's going to be crazy. But 10 years later, Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti had to confirm that indeed there was a secret army named Pladio within the Italian military secret services. And then NATO had to take a stand. NATO first said, we don't want to comment. And then on the next day, they said, yes, there exists something like that, but we can't talk about it because it's a military secrecy. And still today, NATO does not want to talk about Gladio. I mean, most people know that NATO is involved in the war against Libya, but they have no clue about secret operations of NATO during the Cold War.
So what about this operation, Gladio, or Gladio, as he calls it? What is the extent of it, I asked him? And how on earth to penetrate the secrecy of NATO to actually find out who's organising this?
We know now that we had secret armies in Germany, in Belgium, in Italy, in Greece, in Turkey, in France, in Portugal, in Spain, in Norway, in Denmark. In all countries of Western Europe, we had these secret armies. That is a confirmed fact. The second thing which is confirmed is that these secret armies were linked to NATO and MI6, the British Secret Service, and CIA, the American Secret Service, and that they were trained by special forces, the SIS and the special forces of the US, the Green Berets. That is what we know, but we also know that in these countries we had terrorist attacks, but now to link the terrorist attacks in each country to the secret soldiers is very complicated, because we don't have written documentation from NATO which says, for instance, in Belgium we had a series of terrorist attacks, and we can prove we had terrorist attacks, but we don't know what the secret soldiers were linked. In fact, the Belgian Senate tried to investigate the links between the secret army, which existed in Belgium, that is confirmed, and the series of terrorist attacks which are called the Brabant massacres, which took place in the 1980s. And in Germany we had another terrorist attack in Munich in 1980, which was also supposedly linked to the secret network. But there again, you know, people died who wanted to make a statement, and it's very complicated. So it's still an ongoing investigation.
Why should NATO be blowing up bombs in Western Europe and blaming it on somebody else? I mean, most of us think of NATO as a military protection for members of the public in the West.
That's the way I thought of NATO as well in the beginning. I mean, at school, you know, in school I was told that NATO helps to protect democracies, and that you're on the other side of the Iron Curtain with the Warsaw Pact, and there we know they had no respect for human rights and civil rights and crushed down people and everything else. And we know all the details about that. But we know very little, in fact, about secret policies that were carried out in Western Europe during the Cold War. And when I researched for my book, it took me about 4 years, you know, I wrote to NATO and asked them about documentation. I wrote to the CIA and etc. It was part of my PhD at the London School of Economics. I was there and I was in other countries, and it just turned out that NATO wouldn't want to talk about it. So all I learned was really from Italian generals who were directing these secret armies, and they explained that NATO, CIA and MI6 were concerned about the threat of a Soviet invasion. That was one purpose. And they were concerned about opposition within the countries that belong to NATO. And they used a strategy of tension, which basically means that you carry out a false flag terrorist attack and blame it on somebody else. Blame it on your political opponent. Today that would be a Muslim jihadist Al-Qaeda thing. But back in the Cold War, the false flag obviously was blamed on communists. So people at the time had no chance to find out who was really behind the attack. And now, even with 30 or 40 years distance, for us as historians, it's very, very difficult to reconstruct the whole story.
Well, I then asked Daniela Ganser, the author of NATO's Secret Armies and Terrorism in Western Europe, about this whole thorny problem of impunity. Because many of the people that have been organising these terrorist attacks from NATO headquarters in Brussels over the decades are still working there.
The case of the Brabant massacres. The case was that in the 80s, you know, people went shopping in Belgium in the supermarkets, and then you had a group of people armed specially trained men, not, you know, not small robbers who hit you and then run away, but specially armed and specially trained men who came with their cars, stopped in front of the supermarkets, and shot down the people who were there shopping. They didn't even take much money. And you know, some people were running and crying, say, that's my child, and they just killed them, cold-blooded. And in some other instances, the police, who was alarmed and raced to the crime scene, they didn't run away from the police. They even waited for the police to come and shot them too. So they acted like special forces soldiers in a war. I mean, that's what soldiers do. They kill each other. But if you put this situation into a civilian world, like take Belgium, take people's supermarkets, take police office, then you suddenly find out there's something very wrong going on here. And when the Belgian Senate heard in 1990 that in Italy that you had the secret army linked to NATO, which was discovered, you had the Belgian defense minister, Guy Coëm, who flew back from Rome. He happened to be in Italy. So he flew back to Belgium and asked his chief of staff, do we have a secret army in Belgium too? I know nothing about it. And then his chief of staff, which is the highest ranking military in Belgium, said, yes, yes, we have such a secret army. And he said, why don't I know anything about it? And then he said, well, we need an investigation into this whole matter, and we need to find out whether our secret army was linked to these attacks on our population, you know, and whether NATO had anything to do with it. So the Belgian Senate set up a special group of parliamentarians who had to investigate this story. And the incredible thing is that the Secret Service in Belgium just refused to hand out the names. They just didn't give the names of the people who were involved in the secret army. And so researching state terrorism goes to a certain point where suddenly you stop and you don't get the final names and you don't get the courts to actually take over action, because killing people in democracy is just illegal, you know. It's, in the end, it's a question for the courts to handle. But there was nobody condemned for it. Nobody. We just didn't get the names.
Now, I know that the Belgian supermarket attacks happened at a very tense point between Europe and America, where the United States was very keen to have cruise missiles based in Europe, a little bit maybe like the modern-day missile defense shield in Eastern Europe is coming in. The Belgian government didn't want it. Now, after the supermarket attacks, the Belgian government immediately said, well, yes, it does look like there is a threat from the Soviet Union, we better have the cruise missiles.
You always have a political context that actually would favor destabilization. I mean, it's, if somebody looks from it from a distance, and I'm saying from a very immoral point of view, you can say it's very easy to take special forces, to take, you know, secret service operatives who are trained in military warfare and put them into a civilian context. I mean, how easy is that? People shopping, I mean, that's very easy to attack them. And then to cover up the traces is rather easy as well, if you have protection from higher levels. We have right-wing people involved in Belgium, for instance. The Westland New Post was a group of right-wing extremists, and they were involved. And they all said, you know, we checked out when the supermarkets were open, when they closed, and all these details, and whether they had protection or not. And then the journalists, the Belgian journalists who worked on this data, asked the people from the Westland New Post, did you actually carry out the attacks? And then they said, no, no, we didn't do it, but we have protection. We were always in contact with people from NATO and CIA and MI6. So it's always the same group popping up. And then in the end, if you ask CIA, I mean, I placed a Freedom of Information request with the CIA on Gladio and Stay Behind and NATO secret armies. And they just said, you know, we put you on a waiting list and give you an answer in due course, and that's like 8 years ago.
That was Danny Eleganza. I was speaking to him a couple of weeks ago, and he is the author of the book NATO's Secret Armies, and he's based in Switzerland, even though he did his initial research for his PhD here at the London School of Economics. Now, Martin Summers, the implication here, because we're looking at this in conjunction with the anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, is that actually there is a track record of these kind of false flag attacks. Can you give us your take on this whole false flag business?
Well, I mean, I must say I've read Daniel's books, and I'm very familiar with the material he's talking about. There is obviously a question mark over Islamist terrorism when we have a context in which NATO has been involved in false flag terrorism in the past. And that's not conspiracy theory, as you so rightly pointed out at the beginning of this piece. This is all historically documented fact. Bologna railway station was blown up in 1980. I slept in the railway station a week before it was blown up. 86 people died. It was not carried out by the Red Brigades or the neo-fascists. It was carried out by the intelligence services and including MI6. Now, so MI6 have got a track record of blowing up innocent people in order to try and create political effects, and nobody has been punished. And are we surprised that some 50-odd people die on the London Underground on July the 7th? Now, it may be that the story is as the government says, and four random bombers with no mastermind got themselves together and blew themselves up just because they hated our freedoms or whatever the story is. But it's perfectly legitimate for us to ask, as I did ask it when I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque a few years ago, is this a false flag attack? That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. But it may or may not be, but it's an absolutely legitimate question.
Is there actually any evidence that it was a false flag attack, the 7/7 London bombings? Because one thing for certain is we still haven't had a proper public inquiry. The one that's just been announced today into phone hacking, we haven't had the same kind of level of judicial inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings.
Well, as you well know, Tony, it was investigators known to us that uncovered that the train the bombers supposedly caught, which is part of the narrative, they caught the 7 whatever it was from Luton to London.
This is the anonymous government narrative.
Yes, the anonymous government narrative. And through our checking, independent citizen journalist checking, we found that that train didn't run. So they claimed they had CCTV footage of the guys all the way, but they got the train time wrong. Now, how come? What sort of police investigation is it where you've not checked the most basic facts about which train they were or were not on? It suggests immediately that they already have a narrative. But we know who's done this. This is Al-Qaeda. This is the narrative. So we don't need to investigate. We know already. Now, this, of course, is very suspicious. When a bomb goes off, you can't presume you know who did it. It probably takes months to establish what might be the motives and who might have done it. But in most false flag attacks, there's an immediate explanation. And we're told, oh, yes, this is what's happening. It's the communists. It's the Islamists. It's whoever. And when you get an immediate kind of response like that, it should raise suspicions immediately. Because in actual fact, an investigation will take time to determine who's carried out an attack. If within 24 hours they're saying we know what happened, then immediately you smell a rat.
This idea of the false flag, the false flag, isn't it something like to do with naval history?
Yes, it's to do with 18th century naval warfare. Captain Cockayne, who was the hero of Master and Commander, if people have seen that film, he was famous for his false flag attacks. So he would sail his ship right up to a Spanish or a French ship, flying a Spanish or a French flag, so they would think, oh, here's one of our ships. And then when he got right up close, he'd run up the Jolly Roger or the Butcher's Apron, the British flag, and they'd open fire. And that was false flag attacks, as in naval warfare in the 18th century. But of course the concept has since evolved into what we're now talking about.
What might be the motives for the London bombings if it was a false flag attack? Is there an alternative motive?
Well, basically the Islamists had not done anything to the British people at all up to that point. I mean, 9/11 was supposedly carried out by the Islamists, although in fact it probably wasn't. But the British people basically were getting to the idea, well, you know, we've got nothing against the Muslims. I mean, why should we fight them? So we have to be given a reason to hate them. And that's what that would probably be about if it was a false flag attack.
Well, the day after the 6th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, we hear from a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it, and he was promptly sacked. So why does he think that? Who did do it, and how's his claim for unfair dismissal going? His name is Tony Farrell, and he worked for the South Yorkshire Police as a senior intelligence analyst. After much soul-searching, he decided the anonymously authored government version of events simply did not make sense, and told his bosses that the terror threat to Britain comes from something he calls the enemy within. I spoke to him earlier this week.
My name's Tony Farrell, and I used to work as a principal intelligence analyst for South Yorkshire Police. I've been a long servant of the organisation. I joined the service in 1993 and had been a principal intelligence analyst since 1998. I've also done a little bit of secondment work with the Home Office at the Government Office of Yorkshire and the Humber, working on the Crime Directorate. So I was head of profession for one of the largest police forces in the UK, and in September 2010 I was dismissed from that service as a principal intelligence analyst because of my beliefs. So that's why I found myself out of a job. I was dismissed for a belief by the organisation.
Now, what was the belief that you
held?
The
belief was that it concerned a threat, and that was part of my assignment, to produce a threat assessment. The norm was to assume a threat assessment would cover a multitude of sins of criminality, ranging from antisocial behaviour to, say, terrorism. And it was on the issue of terrorism that the clash occurred. My beliefs on terrorism were such that I no longer believed that the major threat came from Islamic terrorism, but it came really from within. And one of the reasons why that was the case was I became disbelieving of the government narratives on 9/11, and more importantly, perhaps in our country, our government narrative on 7/7. So I could not lie and go along with just the government narrative, believing that our government were telling lies themselves.
Now, that's a bit of a strong accusation to make, particularly because the three of the four alleged London bombers come from Yorkshire, don't they, where you were working?
Well, so I was working for South Yorkshire Police. Now, South Yorkshire Police covers Sheffield, Barnsley, Rotherham and Doncaster, whereas the police jurisdiction covering the alleged bombers was West Yorkshire Police, and in particular Leeds and, I think, Beeston.
So what was it that made you feel that, potentially anyway, that the three guys from Yorkshire that came down to London on the 7th of July 2005 and allegedly blew up tube trains, that the actual threat that day may have been from another source?
This became an emerging issue with me. It was shortly before this threat assessment that it dawned on me, and it dawned on me from open source information. So none of what I'm saying actually comes from police information systems. I had no reason to doubt the authenticity of the government's position on this, and the only reason why it came across on my radar was my home interests and my home research from open source information that any researcher out there in the wider world could actually have access to. So I want to say that first and foremost. But the reasons why I became deeply suspicious was when I watched a YouTube video, and it caused me great concern when it became clear that Peter Power was running the mock terror exercise on the very same day, whereby he is on record as saying the terror exercise was simulating the drill at the exact same locations and times as what actually occurred. And to my mind, that immediately aroused great suspicion. It's been downplayed. It is hugely significant, that, and the fact that that's never been investigated properly and brushed aside as just mere coincidence is deeply, deeply suspicious. And the odds of it being just coincidence alone without any connection is simply so remote as to make it virtually an impossibility. So that was the very first thing. But also, there was some interesting documentaries that were available on open source information on the YouTube, some compelling analysis that had been done. And we're talking things like 7/7 ripple effect, the big picture. These documentations were far more persuasive than the official version and the government versions that were available. So there was the unacceptably inept Home Office anonymous account that had holes in it, and actually was proved to have already, you know, by their own admission, has contained lies. And we're talking in terms of the story regarding the train connection from Luton to the Thames link train into London, St Pancras. Well, that clearly, by admission later, was a lie, and it took researchers to actually reveal to them that that was the case. Other issues, Tony Blair, it was deeply suspicious that Tony Blair did not want an inquiry, and that occurred very quickly, within days, and Tony Blair, even on the day of the attacks, was on record as saying that this was being done in the name of Islam. And that was seen to me premature and run contrary to what the police were saying. So that again was deeply suspicious. The profile, the general profile that, of the alleged bombers seems far more consistent with them being set up as patsies rather than bombers. And then there's the reported incidents at Canary Wharf that seem to have been covered up and conveniently unburied, yet they were announced and went across parts of the world, I think in New Zealand. And quite frankly, the alternative hypothesis has been put forward seems to me far more likely, that actually at least one or two of those alleged bombers were taken out in Canary Wharf. And the fact that that seems to have just been brushed aside is deeply suspicious.
Do you think then that that there are systemic problems with the way the police analyse terrorism, that they're kind of in a bubble, and that some of this material from outside simply is not being considered by the police?
I have not been a special branch analyst, so I'm not privy to the detailed intelligence that, say, special branch analysts would have access to. What I can say is that, certainly with my treatment, I was tasked as an analyst to do a strategic threat assessment. So it was my analysis that they were wanting. When my analysis challenged the norm, and my analysis went outside the box in as much as didn't rely on simply compute information within the police, the databases, when I used open source information and challenged the police position by genuinely presenting my analysis and saying I could not present analysis that I think would be misleading, to actually be sacked for standing for what I believed as the analyst to be the truth, as opposed to be a misleading or a lie, there clearly is something wrong with the system that feels it necessary to sack an analyst for standing up for the truth and for actually offering. I offered to the police to produce a detailed report to justify exactly why I felt so confident in saying that I felt the government were lying on this and that there was a threat quite different from the strategic threat that they were articulating and wanted me to perpetuate all my faith, and my conscience simply wouldn't allow that to happen. So I think there is a problem. There is a problem with almost mind control here. You've got to go along with the narrative and you dare not challenge it. And if you challenge it, then your fate could be, in my instance, it's being dismissal. And that's just simply being for a belief and for standing up the truth. And the disappointing aspect is that that seems to run contrary to all the professional standards that the police have. And that means the police don't seem to be walking their talk, I'm afraid.
If the threat, as you say, is not so much from Islamic terrorism, where is the threat from?
I believe squarely that we've got a major issue here, and the threat is an internal one. The threat, I believe, comes from a new world order that actually has an ideology that is evil and wicked. It that ultimately wants to bring about a fascist one world government and police state control. It's an ideology that I believe is a satanic ideology, where the common denominator on all of this is secret societies and many complex interlinking secret societies that are holding this together. And I'm afraid I think the examples of 9/11 and 7/7 are false flag operations and are examples of the New World Order in operation. And we have that, a New World Order in its ascendancy just at the moment. And that, to my mind, is a far bigger threat than Islamic terrorism.
That was Tony Farrell, former senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police, now fighting a case for unfair dismissal. Now, Martin Summers, can you just give us your take on what Tony had to say there?
Well, I think all of the stuff about 7/7 was very much to the point, because he's actually, you know, this guy's paid to analyse these events. He's analysed it correctly, in my view. I think he's jumping to conclusions about who was responsible, and if he says it's New World Order or satanic people or whatever, he means, oh, well, he's just a conspiracy theorist, he just believes silliness. But of course, we've just had Daniel Ganser, who's an academic, pointing out that NATO goes around blowing things up. So it's hardly surprising if we presume that it might be the case in this case as well, is it? They've got four.
Okay, now, 2 weeks ago, the press was buzzing with the leaked words of David Cameron's boss, Witney Constituency Chairman Christopher Shale. He said the Tory party needed to so thoroughly re-examine itself. The Conservative Party of 2011, he said, was voracious, crass, and always on the take. 3 days later, his dead body was found in a public portaloo at the Glastonbury Festival. A swift post-mortem was carried out, but the pathologist said the cause of death appeared to be a natural heart attack, but it was inconclusive. Around the world, there are a few people who specialised in these possible political assassinations, and one is barrister and member of the Royal United Services Institute, Michael Shrimpton. I spoke to him earlier this week from what he called a safe house in New Zealand.
I'm Michael Shrimpton. I am a barrister. That's my day job, but I specialise in intelligence and national security, and in particular I specialise in the esoteric field of counter-assassination or investigation of possible assassinations. But listeners will understand I am expressing myself with loyalty caution, and in the intelligence community we always express any conclusion with qualifications, but at this stage, given the intelligence that's available, I conclude on the balance of probabilities that Christopher Shale was assassinated, and the probable assassinating agency is GO2, or General Operations 2, which is the UK operation of the covert German Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, or DVD, intelligence agency. So it looks as though he was assassinated. That is my conclusion on balance at this moment. And it looks as though the assassinating agency is German, not British.
Now, can you tell us why you think that?
Well, he was certainly in possession of what we call bio-leverage, or high-grade intelligence damaging to a senior member of the government and is in a position to bring it down, and for geopolitical reasons, at the moment, Germany would not wish to see the coalition government collapse. So he was in possession of sensitive information.
What was that sensitive information?
That's... I'm aware of it. You wouldn't be able to broadcast it if I were to tell you, and if listeners could bear with me, I'm sure they'll appreciate that it's simply not intelligence that I could put out over a public radio broadcast. It is sensitive. The senior RAF officer, Air Chief Marshal Sir Christopher Moran, was assassinated again by GO2, again on behalf of the DVD, on 26th May of last year at RAF Bryce Norton, which is in Mr. Shale's West Oxfordshire constituency area. And he was a former officer, of course, 17th 21st Lancers. He did have contacts with the Defence Intelligence Staff, and it's possible, I put it no higher than that, it is possible that he had intelligence on the assassination of Sir Christopher Moran, which is again, was again put down to death by natural causes officially.
Do you think that that there is really any evidence that that really takes place here in Britain?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, we've only got to look at the assassination of David Kelly, for example, which is clearly murder, to see that we have political assassinations. David Kelly's is the latest in a series, but these are not assassinations carried out by British agencies. They are assassinations carried out by overseas agencies, although they may false flag it through British citizens or their assets in British agencies. So one has to be very, very careful. This is nothing to do, for example, with MI5, who are the good guys, nor anything to do with MI6. Although there is a penetration problem of GO2 inside both 5 and 6. So it's important to emphasise that British security agencies don't get themselves involved in political assassinations, and neither the Kelly assassination nor this one nor Sir Christopher Moran was originated in London. The originating agency was based in Munich.
Now, it sounds to me, Michael, that MI5 was supposed to stop this kind of thing going on and have a massive budget of hundreds of millions of pounds to do it, aren't doing their job.
The facts are not entirely clear. The probable assassination was only on Saturday the 25th. There's more work still to be done. But at this stage, I don't think there's any ground for criticising the security service. Now, it looks as though the two GO2 teams, came out of London on Friday the 24th, but they were travelling by separate routes. The teams both met up in London. MI5 may or may not have been tracking one or more members of both teams, but they weren't aware of the target. On the information available to me, they didn't know what was happening, they didn't know who the target was, and there may be some slight ground for criticising lack of coordination on a weekend. I suspect probably the duty officer ought to have called the director in. That would have been a difficult call to make at the time. So although MI5 may have picked up on one or more members of the two teams that were involved, one was a backup, there's always a backup team, it would be unfair to criticise the security service. When an assassination happens, any intelligence agency is going to review it, and most reviewers will come up with suggestions as to what could have been done better in the light of hindsight, but I think it would be unfair to criticise MI5 at this stage.
Now, many people will be thinking, Michael, that what you're saying is just a little bit of wild speculation. Why should we believe what you have to say?
Well, they don't have to believe it. I mean, people have to. People form their own judgment. This is one of my areas of professional expertise. I'm one of the few that is involved in this area, and certainly one of the few that acts, as it were, as a convert between the intelligence community and the wider public. That's partly because I'm not an intelligence officer. I'm not employed by any intelligence agency. I have a degree of independence. I'd like to think I've got a track record of getting assassinations right. I have a track record of rejecting assassinations when they've been put forward as a possible reason for a death or an accident. People have to form their own judgments.
Why do you think, then, that this hasn't really appeared anywhere in the British press at all? Everybody is saying that he's had a heart attack and it's all just an accident.
You see, a lot of assassinations are disguised as heart attacks. Heart attacks are very, very popular. You always have to look at the cause of the heart attack. So the minute you say to an intelligence professional, oh, the death was by a heart attack, that immediately raises concerns. Disguising a heart attack is an extremely popular method of carrying out an assassination that you don't want to present it as an assassination. If you're trying to disguise what you're doing, you're going to want it as an accident or a suicide or death by natural causes. Heart attacks are very popular, particularly if the subject is, like Mr. Shale was, male in his 50s or his 60s. So saying it was a heart attack to an intelligence professional doesn't take the issue much further.
Now, that was, we were speaking there to Michael Shrimpton, who was from the Royal United Services Institute, and around the world there are a few people who specialise in possible political assassinations as he does, and he's talking to us from a safe house in New Zealand. Just to remind you again about the cycle ride, the blog is Kev's Climate Column, and his number's 0768 991 063, and he'll be based in Poulton near Cirencester during the Fairford Air Tattoo. Thanks very much for joining us this week. .org.uk is our website. See you next week.
Station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Britain.